Hello, I'm Derek Barefoot. In this series of studies, I'll be sharing information with you about reason, faith, and the Bible. Consider a few questions before we begin. Do you think it's even remotely possible that the Bible contains unique spiritual truth? If the idea seems too silly to entertain, then stop here and spend your time on something else. On the other hand, maybe to you, the value of the Bible is so obvious that evidence ought to be unnecessary. To you, faith means believing without evidence, even in spite of evidence. If that's how you feel, then this series is probably not your cup of tea either. And don't hesitate to excuse yourself if you're sure that nothing worthwhile is left to be discovered about the Bible and its spiritual claims. If you're still with me, I hope it means you are a bit curious. You might be a person of faith, or a skeptic, but either way, you're willing to take a small risk for the chance to be informed and, maybe, surprised. You won't need a thorough knowledge of the Bible to understand what I present, but I do assume that you know something about it. You should know that the first part of the Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament, presents a story of God's creation of the world and his dealings with an ancient people, the Israelites, who also became known as the Jews. The New Testament tells about the coming of Jesus of Nazareth, whom it claims to be the Son of God and Savior of the world, and about his earliest followers. Briefly, the Bible tells the story of a world alienated from the God who is its source and who has been working and even suffering to put his creation right again. In the first several installments of this series, I won't comment on how certain parts of the Old Testament ought to be interpreted in light of modern scientific and historical theories. As will soon become clear, those issues don't directly touch on the information I'm concerned with. We'll begin with a story. It's about the Bible, not from the Bible. It's legend rather than history, but it will help me illustrate an idea we'll be exploring. The time is the 3rd century BCE, more than 2,000 years ago. The place is Alexandria, Egypt, a coastal city named for Alexander the Great, the young Greek general who, just a few decades before, had conquered territory stretching from Europe to North Africa to India. Alexander did more than create an empire. He spread Greek language and culture across the lands of the Mediterranean. By the time of our story, much of the population of Alexandria had grown up speaking Greek. That was even true of Alexandria's large population of Jews, the descendants of immigrants from ancient Israel. Many of them were more comfortable with Greek than they were with their ancestral language of Hebrew. The most important of the Jewish sacred writings, the Law of Moses, or Torah, appeared in a Greek translation from the original Hebrew around this time. That's the factual part of the story. The legendary part says that the translation of the Torah was commissioned by the Egyptian king Ptolemy II, who was actually from a Greek family. One of Ptolemy's ambitions was to assemble the largest collection of books the world had ever known, the Library of Alexandria. His librarian told him that he needed a version of the famous law code of the Jews in Greek. So, with great fanfare, the king sent all the way to Judea, southern Israel, and commissioned Jewish scholars, 72 of them in all, to come to Alexandria and do the translating. When they arrived, Ptolemy sequestered them on the island of Pharos, a small peninsula that was also the location of the Pharos Lighthouse, one of the wonders of the ancient world. The king asked each scholar to translate the entire Torah, which includes the Bible books we know as Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The scholars worked independently in separate cubicles and finished their work in exactly 72 days. Afterward, when their translations were compared, They all agreed with each other word for word. To this day, the Old Greek Bible is referred to as the Septuagint, from the rounded number 70 in Latin. The legend of the 6 dozen scholars brought to Alexandria by King Ptolemy is implausible for reasons other than the exact agreement of their translations. It's the kind of pious fiction that makes people skeptical of religious stories in general. Still, there is a certain logic to the tale on its own terms. One of our sources for the legend is a Jewish philosopher, Philo of Alexandria, who would have been a teenager about the time when Jesus of Nazareth was born. Philo depended on the Septuagint Greek Bible in his own study and writing, and he had an interest in believing that it had the blessing of God. He was a citizen of Alexandria as well, and must have taken some pride in the role the city played in producing the Septuagint. In one of his treatises, Philo tells the story of the 72 translators and then says, correctly, that there are many different ways that the translation of a document from one language into another might be worded. The agreement of the many translations, says Philo, spoke of an unseen prompter who suggested to the scholars what words to use. If 70 or so translators really did achieve perfect agreement in the wording of their writings without coordinating with one another, we would be justified in considering divine inspiration or some other process outside ordinary human experience. Unfortunately, Philo offers us little evidence for the legend and does not deal with its historical problems, which we won't take time to examine here. Verbal agreement between separate documents is not the only result requiring coordination. We'll leave the example of the Septuagint Greek Bible and consider another hypothetical case. Suppose there were a series of mystery novels written over many years, all featuring a super sleuth, like Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot. After the death of the original author, the publisher has other writers produce books featuring the same detective. Eventually, the publisher discontinues the series, but conducts a survey to determine which of the books have made the most lasting impression on fans. Several hundred readers are asked to vote for their favorite titles from the series. After compiling the results, the publisher reprints the top 4 books as a set. It turns out that only 2 of these 4 novels are by the original author, the other 2 being the work of later writers. Let's say that one of the winning titles is about a scheme to smuggle weapons to insurgents trying to overthrow the government of a small African country. The plot of another concerns embezzlement at a charitable organization that provides food to malnourished people in the developing world. In yet another, one of the members of a wealthy family that owns a chain of mortuaries is plotting against the other heirs to the family fortune. In the remaining book of the 4, a struggling company on the verge of bankruptcy is unexpectedly saved by a rich investor who puts the company back on its feet, then dies under suspicious circumstances. As I described these plots, you probably didn't notice that they correspond in a general way to a famous set of literary figures. The author of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, wrote that in a supernatural vision he saw 4 horses and riders. A rider on a red horse who brought war, one on a black horse who brought famine, one on a pale gray horse symbolizing death, and yet another who was a conquering king or prince riding a white horse. Remember, our hypothetical novels included one about weapons of war, one about a famine relief agency, and one about a family in the business of caring for the dead. A person who arrives to rescue a struggling business or organization, as in the remaining book, is commonly referred to as someone who rides in on a white horse. This correspondence between the mystery books and the figures known as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, if it were noticed, would be considered just an intriguing coincidence, except for one more detail I haven't yet mentioned. Suppose that in the first book of the four to be written, there is a bit of dialogue in which someone asks the detective character if he ever finds himself without cases to work on. "The dark side of human nature keeps my services in demand," he replies, and then adds, "As long as the four horsemen keep riding, I'll have plenty to do." The statement of the character identifying the four horsemen, combined with the plots of the four novels as I've described them, would be astonishing. The authors of the books could not have arranged it, nor could the editors at the publishing house, because the books were chosen by surveying readers. The process by which the set was put together should have been insensitive to the elements of this pattern. We would have reason to question whether the publisher really did choose the books for reprinting by a reader survey, or if there were some other factors at work. Notice that the hypothetical situation I've just described does not turn on a statistical oddity. For example, suppose we found that the number of chapters of each of the four mystery books was a prime number, and that the number of words in the first sentence of each book also was a prime number. That would be a statistically unlikely occurrence, but with enough searching, similar oddities can be found in any work of literature. The difference is that the remark of the detective about the four horsemen and the alignment of the plots of the four books is the kind of unifying strategy that a human author might employ to tie his work together, provided the author had control of both the creation and organization of the books he or she was writing. It makes creative sense, but it requires coordination. Incorporating prime numbers, by contrast, would not make sense as a creative device unless the plots of the books actually involved prime numbers. We now have a framework to help us analyze certain features of the Bible. Like our imaginary quartet of detective novels, the Bible is a set of books. Also, like the four novels, the books of the Bible were not created and organized by a single human author, or even a team of authors and editors. The composition of those books, the acknowledgement of their sacred character, and their collection into what we know as the Bible, was a process that stretched over several hundred years at a minimum, and involved countless discussions, debates, and decisions among scribes, priests, and elders, as well as other influential voices within Jewish and Christian religious communities. In the natural course of events, the compiling of the books of the Bible should have been incapable of producing a patterned organization of material such as the one we proposed for our mystery novels. So, what does the evidence show? In the next segment of this series, we'll start to find out.